Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I am your host, Stephen Dozeman. Rosa Luxemburg occupies a complex place in our history, partly because there are several different Rosas one can find scattered across the world. The feminist activist, revolutionary Marxist, economist, journalist, essayist, and literary critic all have been picked up and co-opted by different movements at different times. While this speaks to her versatility as a thinker, writer, and person, it also reflects the fragmented way in which her writing has been collected, edited, translated, and published. A pamphlet here, an essay there, a book or two, and several collections of letters, but little effort has been made to present her in a thorough, well-organized format. Luckily, that is changing with the ongoing efforts to publish the entirety of her output in English translation, the vast majority of it being translated now for the first time by Verso. Spearheading this project is Peter Hudis and a team of international scholars who are working to collect and translate her work and publish it in a complete format. As of right now, they have published a 500-page collection of letters, two volumes of her economic writings, and a volume of her political writings, all approximately 600 pages, and the series is currently projected to have somewhere between 15 and 20 volumes when complete, although because so much of her work is still being discovered in various archives across Europe, it may expand beyond that as well. This episode will be a sort of introduction where we discuss the basics of Luxemburg's life, the key themes of her work, and the editorial efforts going on behind the scenes to make this project a reality. But we're hoping to do more episodes exploring each volume in greater depth as they're made available. Obviously, a massive project like this is incredibly time-consuming and resource-intensive, which is why the people behind it are asking for your help. While some funds have been made available, the team is still looking for some extra funding to put towards the translation efforts. The editors are not being paid for the work they do on this. For them, it's a labor of love, but the crowdfunding will go to the numerous translators being brought on board. If you are excited and able to help, visit the Toledo Translation Fund and contribute to the project. My guest today, Peter Hudis, is a lifelong activist and is a professor of philosophy in the humanities at Oakton Community College. In addition to being the general editor of the complete works of Rosa Luxemburg, he is the author of Marx's Concept of the Alternative to Capitalism and Frantz Fanon, Philosopher of the Barricades. He also wrote a new preface to the reprint of J.P. Nettle's biography of Rosa Luxemburg, reprinted in a single volume by Verso in 2019. All right, Peter Hudis, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, great to be here.
Yes, yeah, so we always like to have guests introduce themselves at the beginning of episodes. So could you tell us maybe a bit about yourself and what your work and research tends to focus on?
Yes, I'm a professor of philosophy at Oakton Community College. I've been longtime active in the left and the radical movement. And my areas of interest are Marxist theory, Hegelian dialectics, critical theory, race theory, and of course, Rosa Luxemburg, who I think is one of the most outstanding figures in the history of socialism and Marxism, that I became attracted to her work very early in life, though didn't know much about the background of her work. But I found her, when I encountered her writings, one of the most interesting liberatory thinkers within the socialist tradition. And then later on in life, I began to become more devoted to translating her and publishing her and writing about her and other things. So it's basically my areas of work.
Yeah, excellent. So to kick things off with this episode, I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit just about who she was, both as an activist and a theorist. You recently wrote the introduction to the reprint of J.P. Nettle's biography of her, so I'm sure you'll have a couple of things you can say about that. But can you just give listeners a sense of who she was, or just some things that everyone should know about her? Mm-hmm.
Well, the important thing to know, of course, she's a woman. She's Polish. She was born in Zamość, outside, not far from Warsaw, but grew up in Warsaw. She was Jewish. She was disabled. She had a childhood injury that left her partially crippled when she was 5 years old, and caused her to spend a lot of time in bed, where she apparently began to do reading and gain some of her intellectual abilities by putting that to use. I mention these because she's an outsider. She is somebody who is living at the period when the part of Poland that she resided in was part of the Russian Empire. Poland had been divided into Austria-Hungary, Prussia, later Germany, and the Tsarist Empire of Russia. So she was in Russian-occupied Poland as a Jew, as a woman, and as a teenager joins the revolutionary movement, which was fighting for democracy. Of course, Russia at the time was a completely non-democratic Tsarist state, and for socialist revolution. She became convinced that Marxism's critique of capitalism was completely valid, and she wanted to couple a fight for democracy with a fight for socialism. She had to flee her homeland when she was a teenager, because the secret police was breaking up the organization that she was a member of, the Proletariat Party, and that it was made very clear to her that it would be best for her to get out of the country. So she went to Switzerland and studied economics and mathematics and natural science at the University of Zurich, where she got a PhD in economics, which was the first woman, I believe, in Europe to get a PhD in economics at the time. So she's a pathbreaking thing, comes from a very humble background in a way, a middle-class family, educated middle-class and assimilated Jewish family. But she ends up in Zurich University and writes a quite remarkable dissertation called The Industrial Development of Poland, which deeply impressed her professors that were on the dissertation committee for its erudition and its rigor for somebody so young. But she didn't want to stay in Switzerland, which was a backwater in terms of politics. She really wanted to be where the heart of the socialist movement was at the time. That is, now we're talking the late 1890s. Germany was, of course, the fastest growing economy in the world at the time. And it had the largest socialist movement and the fastest growing socialist movement at the time. She wanted to be in the center of the action. So she moved to Berlin in 1898. And as soon as she lands in Berlin, she's involved in a political controversy within the German Social Democratic Party, which was the socialist party that had over 1 million members at the time, affiliated with the Second International, which was the international organization of socialist parties that had been formed about a decade earlier. And she involved herself in all sorts of political controversies within that organization. And one of the most famous ones is her debate with Eduard Bernstein over the question of reform or revolution. That is capitalism evolving, as Bernstein argued, in a direction that contradicts Marx's predictions? That is, capitalism is becoming less violent, less savage, less repressive, and it will naturally give way to socialism? Or do you still need a revolution in order to exit from capitalism? Luxembourg argued the latter, Bernstein the former, and they came into a bitter polemic over this issue. And still, she's a pretty young, right? She's not 30 years old yet. She writes this book, Reform or Revolution, which becomes quickly known throughout Europe as the most profound and incisive critique, not just of Bernstein, but of reformist tendencies within socialism that wanted to accommodate in some way with existing society. From there, she becomes gradually a major figure within this German Social Democratic Party and the Second International. Even though she didn't have a formal leadership position, women, of course, had no right to vote at that period in Germany. But she had no formal position within the party leadership, but she wrote for many of the party publications. She was an organizer on the election campaigns, urging people to vote for socialist candidates. And she involved herself in doing an array of other theoretical work, which included eventually becoming a teacher in the Social Democratic Party's school in Berlin, where they trained party comrades and trade unionists in Marxist theory. And this was one of her great loves of her life. She spent 7 years as an activist, as a theoretician, and as a, well, not quite full-time, but almost full-time teacher. So a lot of different dimensions of her work are rolled up in her life. I would have to say what really makes her remarkable is her involvement in direct involvement in one of the most important revolutions of modern times, the 1905 revolution in Russia. This was very unexpected, at least for some people. Russia at the time was a backward country, was just beginning to quasi-industrialize. It did not have a strong socialist movement, at least, and nor could it, because everything that was oppositional had to be underground. Germans tended to look, Western Europeans tended to look at Russia as a backwater and as lacking sophisticated political movements, let alone theoretical direction for them. And yet the 1905 revolution breaks out and it becomes the most serious challenge to any existing society that's been seen since the days of the Paris Commune or even the 1848 revolutions. And Luxembourg throws herself into supporting this revolution. She writes some brilliant analyses about it. She tries to translate or transmit the lessons she learns from the revolution in Russia to her experience in Germany. She travels to Russian-occupied Poland to directly take part in the revolution. And it's at that point that she meets Lenin, she meets Trotsky, she meets Zinoviev, she meets Martov, different leaders of the Mensheviks and Bolsheviks. And she develops a whole series of theoretical and political works based on that interchange. So she's an important political figure. And of course, I haven't mentioned the most important part, perhaps, of her political life, which is then her involvement directly, but she was in jail during the 1917 Russian Revolution for opposition to World War I, but she was freed from jail by the German Revolution of 1918. And then she spent the last several months of her life trying to advance that revolution beyond the confines of a liberal democratic state towards a socialist revolution. So her political work is very wide encompassing and significant. But she also, and this is often neglected in a lot of discussions of Luxembourg, we have a weird compartmentalization. People interested in the humanities and politics and activism, of course, they are attracted and look at her political writings. But she was an outstanding economist, not just in the dissertation she wrote to get her PhD, but she wrote three other major economic works, books, full-length books on economics, that I think put her up there as among the three or four most significant economists of the 20th century, in my humble opinion, perhaps the most significant woman economist in some respects of the first half of the 20th century. So she's somebody who embodies these different dimensions. And last but not least, I should mention an amazing personality. This was a woman who was not afraid to make her voice heard, despite being denigrated for being a woman in a male world. The political parties of the time were completely male-dominated. Being from a so-called backward place like Russian-occupied Poland, being a Jew at a time when anti-Semitism was not only rampant in society in general, but within the socialist movement itself, at least in aspects of it, she had to claw her way to the top by herself and with some help from her colleagues against a lot of obstacles. And yet she never lost her sense of humanism. Her correspondence is wonderful to read, to see about her wide-ranging interests, not just in literature, which she talks extensively in her correspondence, but her interest in the human personality. How can one maintain one's political activism and theoretical work as an academic, or in her case, outside the academy, but not lose sight of the importance of the personal and loving relationships and the emotional side of human existence? And this is brought out in some incredible letters she wrote back and forth to her comrade and lover, Leo Yogeshes, who were together for some 17 years in a relationship, and letters she wrote after their breakup, dealing with these personal as well as political issues that many people a century later look back on and see her as actually a kind of important literary figure.
Yeah, that's an excellent kind of overview of her life. You kind of alluded to this a bit, but I wanted to ask, you talk about the compartmentalization of her. She's an activist to some, a theorist to others, to some she's a Marxist, to others she's a feminist. So she's kind of been picked up and disassembled in various ways. So I'm wondering if you can speak a little more to that, her kind of weird place, not just within the Marxist tradition, but within a whole variety of different currents that have kind of picked up different parts of her, often to the exclusion of others. Can you speak to that a bit?
Sure. Great question. Well, you know, the fact that she's interpreted in different ways through different lenses is actually a very good thing in a way, because a work of first of all, as D.H. Lawrence once put it, a work of art is never great unless it escapes its author. In other words, its meaning lies in how it impacts people who come after the author has penned the work. Okay, and if you think of Luxembourg's life as a kind of work, right, that she wrote, that's certainly true. In other words, we look back on previous thinkers in history or figures in history, whether it's in the arts or whether it's in the sciences or in revolutionary politics, and we interpret them with eyes of the problems of our own time. So before the second wave of feminism in the 1960s, it didn't occur to most people to think of Luxembourg in terms of feminism, because she wasn't actively involved in the women's movement of her time. There was a very strong women's movement in Germany, and she never publicly called herself a feminist. So it was just assumed that, well, that's not what she was interested in. But, you know, a new movement or a new era gives new eyes or a new lens to see things in a thinker that might not have been noted before. So in the 1980s, a number of feminist theoreticians began to look at Luxembourg anew and saw that, yes, she didn't want to be, she did not want to be, as she put it at the time, sidetracked into working on the so-called woman question, which for many men, party leaders, were very happy for her to do that, because then she wouldn't be in the way of, they wouldn't have to worry about her criticisms of them. Let her work on the margins in the woman's auxiliary, so to speak, and they maintain control of the theoretical arsenal of Marxism. She wanted to get into that theoretical arsenal and be a contributor to it. So nevertheless, the point is that with feminism, yes, some people read her or still read her as not interested in feminism. Much more accurate is this lens that feminist theorists have provided to see that she had a profound feminist dimension in many different aspects of her work, even though it wasn't what she focused much of her political attention on. Now, the same thing happens on other levels, right? Right now, there's a conference going to be held in 2 weeks in Berlin, celebrating the 150th anniversary of her death. There's going to be several panels on Rosa Luxemburg and the issue of decolonialism. Now, in one sense, this springs directly from her work, because one of the most important aspects of her economic work was arguing that colonialism and imperialism are necessary so long as there's capitalism. Not every country who's capitalist has to engage in colonialism or imperialism, but as a global system, capitalism cannot exist without colonialism and imperialism. But the point is that prior to just only maybe a few years ago, this aspect of her work was not focused on as much, and definitely another aspect that's embedded in that work on critique of colonialism and imperialism on her part, the question of racism, wasn't discussed at all. And yet here we have the Black Lives Matters movement of the last year, and we have around the world, I'm seeing various discussions of people saying, hey, what did Luxembourg have to say about race and its relationship to capitalism? Does she ever talk about racialized capitalism? How can we use her work or view her work to understand the inseparability of racial discrimination and the capitalist mode of production? This is a discussion that's now happening. Again, it wouldn't have happened a generation ago, let alone and even more recently than that. But the issues of our day give no eyes to see things that we didn't see before. Of course, there's always a danger to reading into a thinker and reading things that aren't there, or overreading them, perhaps, or simply trying to fit them into a kind of cubbyhole of your own preoccupation at the which doesn't fit her historical era. And this happens very often with Luxembourg. I would have to say that she died a tragic death, right? She was martyred in the cause of the revolution. She was a leader of the German Revolution who was killed by the proto-fascists called the Freikorps in 1919. So one of the problems of being a martyr, besides, of course, not surviving, is, with some exceptions, it's hard to criticize you. In other words, people who were politically adversaries of hers after her death claim to still be working in her spirit, such as a certain West Germany had a postage stamp for Rosa Luxemburg. East Germany had a postage stamp for Rosa Luxemburg, even though they were both completely opposite systems and very hostile to each other. So the contemporary politics gets involved in this then. Different tendencies trying to appropriate her name for causes that might not have been her own. And that is always, I think, a problem with a thinker. And of course, no one suffered more from this than Marx, who is so wrongly associated with what called itself Marxism in the repressive regimes that used his name as their founding ideology in the 20th century. Because I think if Marx had been around to see 20th century communism, statist communism, he would not have said that had anything to do with anything he advocated. And I think Luxemburg would say the same. So it's a difficult question that you asked, but I think she's a multidimensional figure, so she's bound to be read in multidimensional ways. And now we can begin to do that more accurately now that we're getting the full text of her works available in English. At least it'll take some time to get them all out, but we're in the process of doing so.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, kind of jumping right off of that, now that at least some of the texts are starting to be translated and published, and as they're kind of slowly being disseminated around, do you see her place in contemporary Marxist scholarship kind of changing or adjusting? Do you see people kind of picking up her work and trying to wrestle with it in new ways? Does she have a place in the contemporary theoretical left? Or is that maybe kind of still developing, too much to say? But
right. Definitely the answer to that is yes. And here is why. Luxemburg dies in 1919. She never gets to lead a successful socialist revolution or even to participate in a successful social revolution. Where there was a revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, which claimed to be attempting a transition to socialism, is the one that won out. Now, she was a supporter of that revolution. She supported the Bolshevik seizure of power, but she developed criticisms. She had criticisms of the regime for suppressing democratic liberties, for some of their policies in terms of relationship to the peasantry and also national minorities. The point is that, as the old saying goes, nothing succeeds like success. Here was Luxemburg, the theoretician, who dies trying to make a revolution that fails. Lenin makes a revolution that succeeds. So, and then the revolution that Lenin leads, and Lenin, of course, greatly admired Luxemburg, although he had a lot of criticisms of her and vice versa. By the late 1920s, the Bolshevik regime comes under the control of Stalin and Stalinism, which views Luxemburg as a grave, grave threat to them, because she argued there can be no socialism without democracy and no true democracy without socialism. Now, that is not something you tell Joe Stalin to make him to become popular with him. So she was read out of the communist movement. But then you had all these communist revolutions that spread around the world, or at least communist regimes that came to power. So Luxemburg was sidelined. She seemed to be, like, to many people, a historical figure only. the big players in town in the left were Marxist-Leninism on one side and social democracy on the other side, which was meaning something different than the social democracy she joined in the 1890s in Germany. This became basically a kind of a liberal critique of capitalism. So that begins to change, though, in the 1960s when a new left emerges and a new generation of revolutionaries emerges around the world who says, is there a third way? Is there a way that we don't have to accommodate to capitalism like social democracy has, but that we don't have to, in opposing capitalism in a revolutionary manner, go down the path of statist authoritarian dictatorships of the Soviet Union, Communist China, et cetera. So Luxembourg comes back into play in the late 60s. People are looking for this third path. But the irony is that even though she influences a great number of people in that period, in the 60s and 70s, the basic understanding of socialism that was held around the world did not change that much. People still thought of socialism as state control of property, end of a market economy, planned production, a planned economic system. And the inseparability of democracy and socialism and how socialism has to go beyond simply ending private property or anarchic market relations, but creating new human relations in the workplace and outside of it. These were all concerns of Luxembourg that just didn't get as much traction, especially as much of the new left kind of regressed into either liberalism or of a kind of a vapid Marxist-Leninism. So there's a long stretch again, but then 1989 happens and it's the collapse of these so-called Marxist-Leninist regimes, communist regimes. And now it doesn't look the same, right? It doesn't anymore look as it had for 70 years that, well, Lenin was the one who had a program that worked. Luxembourg may have had nice ideas, but, you know, it never did anything. Now you look and you say, well, wait a second, even without equating Lenin to Stalin, which I don't, the point is Lenin's light is not shining, given all that happened in the 20th century. Luxembourg's light is. People go back and they say, oh my gosh, she was predicting what would happen to a revolution like Russia in 1918, a year after they came to power, if they suppress democracy and do not open up the society for democratic deliberation, there won't be a transition to socialism. You can't create socialism by imposing it behind people's backs. I mean, she was saying this throughout her writings in the early 20th century. So now in the early 21st century, as is an effort to revive the concept of socialism on a totally different foundation than what has existed for the last 100 years, and it has to be a totally different foundation in order to succeed, a lot of elements of Luxembourg's work come into play. That doesn't mean she gives us the answers to how to work out a completely adequate conception of socialism for our life and times, but there's plenty in Luxembourg that can direct us to that goal.
Yeah, excellent. So I think that sets up a lot of great background. I want to shift gears and start talking about some of the archiving and editorial work that's been done with her publications. So before turning to the English editions that you are working on, I want to talk about the history of editing and collecting her work in its original languages. You noted in the introduction to Nettle's reprinted biography that even in German, there are still new volumes being compiled very recently. And I imagine a lot of challenges come up because it crosses several different languages in so many different places. So can you talk a bit about the history of her work even before translating it? You know,
Right. Very, very good point. Because of this kind of making Luxembourg into a non-person since from the late 1920s or even middle 1920s, right through the 1960s until let's say this late 60s, you have this 40-year period where she's kind of a non-person with some exceptions. And so very, very little of her work is available, even in German. And in English, a pitifully small amount of her work was translated. Some of it was translated here and there, mainly by small radical groups. And frankly, the group that translated more of her work into English than maybe anybody was a left-wing political party in Sri Lanka, of all places. Sri Lanka had a very progressive left-wing regime in the 60s for a while, and they gave support for the publication of Luxembourg's, at least a party that was part of the coalition government, supported the publication of Luxembourg's writings in English in Sri Lanka. And that's how some people in Europe and America got a hold of Luxembourg's books, believe it or not, in the 60s or early 60s. The point is that in Germany, in East Germany, she couldn't be discussed really until this began to change gradually in the late 60s, but definitely in the 80s, before the fall of the wall. There is a small circle of people in East German academia who have enough leeway now to begin to publish her work and to revisit her legacy more systematically. And this results in Dies Verlag, which was originally the publishing company of the East German Communist Party, but now, of course, since then, for the last 30 years, has been an independent, very important publishing company in United Germany, began to publish her complete works, collected works, Gesammeltwerke. And this was five volumes of about roughly 500 pages, 400 or 500 pages apiece, 600 pages apiece, collecting her political writings and some of her economic writings. But it was not complete because certain things you could not publish in East Germany, or they would not want to take the chance with. A lot of her writings were done not, and it only included, for the most part, writings she wrote in German. But Luxembourg also wrote an enormous amount of material in Polish, not just because she was from Poland, but she headed the Marxist Party in German, in Poland, which was an underground party. And she was the leading figure in that party for some 20 years. And there's a ton of material that she wrote in Polish. That material only recently has started to get into German. Some of it was in German before, but bulk of it is only starting to get into German now. It's still not even mainly in German. And almost none of it got into translation into English until we're beginning to do so now. So there was big gaps in the understanding of Luxembourg. Even today, I don't think people have a full view of what Luxembourg was like as a political activist, because if you subtract out or ignore her work within the Polish movement, you're not getting a complete picture there. And you have to measure her writings against her own political practice. And the only way to do that is to look at what she was doing inside the Polish movement. And there's not that, unless you read Polish or have access to those documents, it's not likely to get that. So this material now is starting to be translated. So the Gesammeltwerke that was East German published, there was a second edition of the collected works in German that was done later after the fall of the Berlin Wall, which is somewhat improved, but still not complete. Now for myself and others like me who came to political consciousness in the 1970s, when I started to get interested in radical theory and came across the work of Luxembourg, you know, I came across like pamphlets like The Reformer Revolution. I knew about this book, The Accumulation of Capital, though I hadn't read it yet. It was too difficult for me to handle when I was younger. The Mass Strike pamphlet and her pamphlet, the booklet on the Russian Revolution, The Critique of the Bolsheviks. These writings were already translated and were known. I thought that was basically Rosa Luxemburg. That was her basic corpus of writings. But as I began to get deeper into studying her, I realized this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we in the English-speaking world don't have 80 to 90% of what she wrote. I mean, this is what I was saying to myself 30 years ago. Now we have maybe, 80%. We're missing 80%. We have maybe 20, 25% of what she wrote. There's a huge amount of her writings that haven't gotten into English. The major works are in English. But there's a lot of significant essays, quite lengthy. There's manuscripts, there's drafts, there's lectures, there's letters, and there's an assortment of journalism, newspaper articles. She was a prolific journalist. Most of that not in English. So we're trying to correct that with the complete works of Rosa Luxemburg. Now, in terms of what you mentioned about German writings, just two things here, quickly. There's a series of magnificent scholars in Germany that have been spending literally their entire lives, not just studying what Rosa Luxemburg wrote, but discovering what she wrote. That is tracking down manuscripts or anything they can find by Luxemburg in archives and libraries or wherever they can. And the foremost person in this was Anneliese Leschiska. She was one of the co-editors of the Gesammeltwerke in Germany and wrote a very excellent, unfortunately not yet translated into English, biography of Luxemburg. She spent 40 years of her life or more devoted to collecting materials by Luxembourg. And that's not an easy job because Luxembourg wrote many of her journalistic articles either anonymously or under a pseudonym. The German collected works chose to only include materials by her that were signed. which leaves out the majority of her journalism. And also, for the reason that it was not clear whether she wrote them or not. Well, people like Annalise Leschiska, Attica Luban, others in Berlin, figured out which are by Luxembourg and which are not in these unsigned or anonymous articles. So by the, well, within, let's say, 5 or 6 years ago, the amount of material was quite stunning that was collected. And it was published, it's been published in 2 volumes in Germany, each volume 1,000 pages long, volume six and volume seven of her Gesammelte Werke, 2,000 pages worth of material written in German that nobody in Germany knew about before. This just in the last 6 years. We're now translating some of that material into English. Eventually we'll translate all of it. But in addition to that, it turns out there's all this Polish writings. And I still don't know how many pages of it there are, but certainly at least 1,500, maybe 2,000 pages worth of material in Polish, which vast majority of it never translated to any language, and as a matter of fact, unavailable in Poland, not reproduced in Poland either since her death. So there's a lot of material now to work from, and it makes very challenging the task of putting together a complete works. When I started on this project, I thought it would be pretty straightforward. You just take the Gesammelte Werke, translate it to English, and bingo, you've got a complete works of Rosa Luxemburg. I was very naive. Then as I start working on the project, I hear, oh, there's this manuscript that just been found. There's that manuscript. We hear about some other manuscript that hasn't been found yet. And you begin to get a lot more material. So this is what we're trying to do. This is what one has to do to try to put the pieces of a great figure together. And as we do that, we can both appreciate her legacy better and also avoid certain stereotypes that might be the result of a one-sided reading.
Yeah, excellent. So that kind of leads right into discussing the English translations that you're working on. So I first want to ask just kind of a broad question. You've talked about the scope, like it is intended to be very complete, but I also want to ask about the way you're organizing it. So far, you've got a volume of letters, a couple volumes of economic writings, and a couple volumes of political writings. So I just want to ask kind of where how you're kind of sorting these and what other genres you're going to be including. I'm sure there will be volumes of journalistic writings as well. So can you maybe speak to how you're kind of organizing, you know, these thousands and thousands of pages of work?
Right. Well, there was a lot. It's a complicated procedure to put out a complete works, given some of the factors I've mentioned. So how do you do that? I mean, one approach, the simplest approach, the most straightforward, would be to have a chronological, you know, start off with, you know, her earliest writings in 1893 or so, and then go up to her latest in 1919, volume by volume, not grouped by theme or anything like this, just straight chronology. But there's problems with that, because then there's problems with it on a number of levels, one of which is that you first have to have all the material in front of you before you can do the chronological ordering. And as material is still to be discovered or is in the process of being discovered or made available, that becomes very, very difficult. So a decision was made early on in the process that we were originally thinking of doing it chronologically. We decided, no, let's do it thematically. So the complete works are divided into 3 rubrics, 3 separate sections. 1, economic writings. 2, political writings. 3, correspondence. Now, it's a bit of an artificial division because she was not an academic economist. She was writing on economics as part of her political project of advancing the cause of socialism. But at the same time, as she herself says, many of those economic writings, what she called technical scientific treatises, right, which don't have direct political application, like her work, The Accumulation of Capital, which has political implications for sure, but it's on a rather narrow, specific aspect of Marxist theory that, at least in her day, would be something of interest mainly to specialists in the field, not necessarily the general public. That's changing now, though. But in any case, we decided better to have to start with the economic volumes, have several volumes of her economic work, and then proceed with her political writings. Now, why begin with the economic writings instead of the political? Why do one versus the other? Well, she wrote, as I mentioned, 4 books on economics in her lifetime. One was her dissertation, which was published after she got her PhD as a book. The second was a great magnum opus called The Accumulation of Capital, written in 1913, a 400- or 500-page mammoth study. The third was a defense of that book against her critics called The Anti-Critique. And the fourth was a book that was only published after her death from her notes or from draft chapters called The Introduction to Political Economy. This came out of her work as a teacher at the Party School in her effort to give an account of economic history and the nature of capitalism. But The Introduction to Political Economy, unlike the other three that I mentioned, had not been translated to English until 2013, when we published it in the first volume of The Complete Works of Rosa Luxemburg. Only one chapter was available. So we thought there's a number of, it's best to begin with the economic writings, because not only has The Introduction to Political Economy not appeared in English before, even though it had been in Italian, French, Spanish, and other languages for a long time, there was also a whole series of other economic writings, notes, essays, etc., in preparation for these four economic works, which had never been published in English. So we figured there's so much new material in economics, and that is really where her stature as a theoretician comes in, that will start with several volumes of her economic writings and then go to a political writing. So volume one deals with almost all the material in volume one of The Complete Works is material that had not previously been translated into English or even available before in any language. The second volume has new translations of two of those four works on economics, Accumulation of Capital and The Anti-Critique, which was needed because the earlier translation was done back in the early 1950s and it had some problems. Then the rubric of political writing starts with volume three. We actually are going to produce a third volume on economics, by the way. It's going to be like volume 2B, because we've also been made aware of about 300 pages of other notes and such, not published material by her, on economics that we didn't know about when we were doing volumes one and two. Now, the political volumes are arranged by theme as well. They're broken down into sub-themes. So political writings, but grouped into like four or five themes. The first theme is writings on the question of revolution, directly on revolution, actual revolutions. What did Luxemburg say and do about actual revolutions? Second, and that we have three volumes prepared for that. Volume three, which has already been published on the 1905 revolution. Volume four, which is also on the 1905 revolution. And volume five, which covers her writings on revolution up to the 1917 and 1918 revolutions. Volume four is in print and should be out by the fall or late summer. Volumes five is being edited now and should be out. Well, when it'll be out, it's a good question, but it'll be done and ready for publication by next year. That's the first theme of the political writings, three volumes on revolution. The next theme, which we're starting on now, is debates on revolutionary strategy and organization. What did she say about the different political debates within the organized left over issues of tactics, strategy, and organization? Also includes the question of spontaneity. What does she write about that? That's going to be in at least three, maybe four volumes that would cover from chronologically from 1893 to 1919. Each one of these themes is arranged chronologically, but they're separate themes. The third theme would probably be her writings on the national question and nationalism. There is a short volume that was published of selections of her writings on nationalism back in the 70s, but there's about, I would estimate, a good 1,600 pages worth of material that has not been in English that we would find its way into that theme, three or four volumes on the national question. Also, several volumes on colonial policy and what we call imperialism today. And there would be at least one volume, probably one volume, on her literary work. She also wrote some very interesting things on literature and culture. All of these volumes have journalistic writings in them. Even the economic volumes have a couple of writings on economics that were originally published in periodicals. Volume three, which is already out, dealing with the writings on the 1905 revolution is 90% newspaper articles and journalism. So that material is woven in into each theme. So it has published material that she published in her lifetime, material that are in the form of newspaper articles, essays, speeches, etc. Then once that's out of the way, that is the volumes on political writings, which would be at least 9 volumes, I would have to say at this point, we're looking at, maybe more, we would then do the complete correspondence. Verso thought it would be a good idea when we were beginning the project to first publish a more comprehensive collection of her letters. There's been a number of very fine collections of her letters published in English over the years, but none of them were much more than 200 pages or so. And there's a lot of letters she wrote. So we took a collection of her letters that Annalise Leschiska had published in Germany some years back, amended it somewhat, and published that in a new translation as The Letters of Rosa Luxemburg in 2011 as a companion to the series. But there's 5 volumes of correspondence in German. That's maybe 20% of her correspondence, the volume that we published. So there's a lot more letters that haven't seen the light of day, at least to an English-speaking audience. Those will be in like 5 volumes at the back end of the process. So that's how we get to 17 to, or 18 or maybe 19 volumes. God willing, we live so long.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to ask about the letters volume you've already published as kind of a companion volume. As I was looking through it, it's like about 500 pages with something around 800 footnotes, you know, explaining key people she's corresponding with, dates, events going on in the background. So one can kind of like casually peruse through it, just kind of get a sense of her day-to-day life and her prose and writing ability. But it's also very clearly a very scholarly volume meant for people who are really trying to understand the background against which her theoretical work was done, her activist work. So I'm wondering if you can talk about your intentions with this and what you mean when you say it's a companion volume and the sort of work that went into that.
Right. Thank you for that question. Yes. Obviously, you know, those who are working this project love Rosa Luxemburg very much. I mean, we wouldn't be working on this unless we thought she was worthy of the effort. But we want to do, we want to make sure from the beginning when we started this project that we are going to be as objective as possible and not kind of, you know, write footnotes that are tendentious or opinionated or simply are a way to launch attacks on people and this sort of thing, which has happened with her works earlier. I'll give you an example. There was a former American communist named Bertram Wolf, who then became an anti-communist when he realized what the Soviet Union that he so adored turned out to be. And he published in the early 1960s a book called Leninism or Marxism by Rosa Luxemburg, which had 2 sections. One, a 1904 essay critiquing Lenin on his organizational theories, and the other was the first English translation of her booklet criticizing the Bolsheviks for their policies after 1918, and also which contains also positive evaluations of the Bolsheviks. Now, of course, Luxemburg never wrote anything under the title Leninism or Marxism. Wolf was using this as kind of an instrument within the Cold War to claim Luxemburg for anti-communism. And now it's not what he included in the books was what she wrote, but of course, with plenty of tendentious footnotes that try to steer the reader in understanding what she really meant in one or another direction. We wanted to make sure to avoid anything like that from any direction. So we took great care, and we didn't always succeed, I think. There's a couple of footnotes I would write differently today, but the point is that we tried to take care in as many places as possible to present an objective recording of the facts that the reader should know about a particular reference that Luxemburg makes. We're not going to quote somebody like a Menshevik thinker and say, oh, Rosa Luxemburg is referring to a counter-revolutionary Menshevik, some nonsense like this, or this individual is a petty bourgeois leftist, which Luxemburg was critiquing. the reader can make up their own mind what they think of these people. We simply want to give it straight and be as factually accurate as possible. And that's what I think you meant when you said scholarly footnotes. That's what you try to do in a project like this. And the beauty of the Letters volume is that it provides an entree into Luxembourg's work. I mean, Luxembourg's economic writings are not easy to get into. If you don't have some background in economic theory, and especially not in Marxist economic theory, if you dive just into the accumulation of capital, you're going to have a hard time. And some people will simply not be that interested in that area for work. And there are people who can dive directly into political writings, but there's others who might be turned off. That's not exactly what's floating their boat either, because he's talking about political events that happened a century ago that many of us don't really feel that much at stake in. So the Letters volume gives you a vantage point into her personality and her range of interests. And you can see her thinking out loud to her lovers, to her comrades, to the world at large, to the titmice in her prison cell, which she, the only being she can talk to, okay, when she's in solitary confinement for opposing World War I. She had several other prison spells in prison. So it's a magnificent entree into who Luxembourg is and what her voice is. So it really is a good way through the letters to get to know Rosa Luxemburg. When people who aren't that familiar with her work ask me, what can I read of Luxembourg? I will usually send them as a holiday present, the Letters volume. And then from there, of course, you can get into the weeds of her more in-depth theoretical and political writings from there, if it so interests you. So there's many people who have found fascination with Luxembourg's work who are not even Marxist. We're not Marxist or not socialist, and that's all the better, right? In other words, a person who speaks to different individuals, depending on where their background is a very meaningful thing. But of course, at the same time, that doesn't mean Luxembourg was not a socialist and was not a Marxist. She gave her life for revolutionary socialism. And anybody who would try to deny that one would get a few words from me.
Yeah. So as a final question, I just want to talk about, you're actually working on crowdfunding the collection right now. You've got a few volumes published, but you still just have a mountain of stuff to translate. So I'm wondering if you could just tell listeners about that a bit, and how they can maybe help in their own little way to bring this to fruition.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, I should say from this get-go that this project would not be possible without the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation in Berlin, which is an organization that's been founded quite a number of years ago that's not exclusively or specifically devoted to Rosa Luxemburg per se. Institute is named after her. But they do a lot of important educational work around Rosa Luxemburg, and they have helped to provide funds for our project. What funds are involved in the project? All of us, myself included, who's the general editor, we have an editorial board of 16 people. All of us do this work for free. It's a labor of love. We don't get paid a nickel for it. We don't expect to get paid a nickel for it. The only people who get the only cost factor is the cost of translations, which of course is considerable. When you have you're producing a 600-page volume, that's 600 pages of material translated from Russian, German, and Polish, right? There's actually a few things of hers in Yiddish as well that we'll get to at some point. But the point is that the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation has been very helpful in helping to get us money for covering the cost of translations, but they can't cover the complete cost. So we have to have supplementary funds to make the volumes possible. And for that, there is a Toledo Translation Fund named after the famous school of Muslim translators that existed in Toledo, Spain during the Middle Ages, the Toledo Translation Fund. And if you just typed into a search engine, Rosa Luxemburg Toledo Translation Fund, it would bring you right away to a page called The Complete Works of Rosa Luxemburg, describes the project, says how much money we're trying to raise for the next several volumes, in particular volumes 6, 7, and 8. We don't have enough money yet to commission translations for those three volumes. We have some, but not enough. So for this project to go forward, we are doing this kind of crowd sharing. And if anybody can make a contribution, that would be greatly, greatly appreciated. And I just want to add finally to that, that there's really exciting stuff that's just now being translated to give you an idea of what's there. I mean, the volume 4, which will be out later this year, for instance, includes detailed notes she made of the English Revolution of the 1640s, right? Which we didn't know even existed before. There's an essay from 1908 that she wrote in Polish, about a 30-page essay about the question, what happens when you make a revolution or in a country, but no other country joins you in that revolutionary process? Can you sustain a transition to socialism where there is no international revolution? It's a fascinating question that, of course, is the question that all revolutionaries have had to face for the last 100 years, right? Can you make a successful socialist society when you're surrounded by it, if you're an island in the sea of capitalism? And it's in English, it will be in English for the first time in volume 4 of the complete works. And there's dozens of other pieces raising these sorts of really contemporary issues that, again, many of these writings were just unknown a few years ago. So this is worthwhile work, I think. I'm being subjective because I'm involved in it, but I think it is worthwhile.
Yeah, it all sounds fascinating and very exciting. So, Peter Hudis, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Stephen, very much for the opportunity.